This is Karen Lyle with Latitude 38's Max Ebb on Sailsport Talk. Let's eavesdrop on a conversation between Max Ebb and Lee Helm on Sailing Science.
Question for Lee Helm.
Yeah?
On the weather map, why does the wind always flow clockwise around a high-pressure system?
Okay, Max, so, like, which way does the Earth turn?
There you go with that Socratic dialogue again. Let me think a second. The sun rises in the east, sets in the west, so the Earth must be turning the other way, counterclockwise.
Yes. Now remember, the air wants to flow from high pressure to low.
I didn't know that air had free will. I think of a high pressure system as syrup poured in the middle of a pancake. Air descends to the surface and then spreads out away from the high pressure at the center.
Yeah, the air has momentum and will try to go straight. But the Earth is turning underneath it, so to us people on the rotating Earth, we think the air is going clockwise.
So it's more like maple syrup poured on a pancake on a record player. Is this a Northern Hemisphere record player or a Southern Hemisphere record player?
Northern, for sure. The air totally wants to go straight. But we're looking at it from the spinning Earth, a rotating frame of reference. So to us, it seems like the air is always being flung to the right. This is called Coriolis acceleration, named for the French mathematician J.J. Coriolis, 1792 to 1843. Snap!
I saw that at a science museum. It was a merry-go-round with kids trying to roll a soccer ball to each other. It looked like magic. The ball would not roll straight.
Yeah, but, like, actually, the ball really was going straight. It was the observers who were rotating, so the ball gave the illusion of rolling along a curved path.
So much for magic.
Well, try this in your car. Adjust the heater vent to aim the stream of warm air at your right ear. Then make a sharp left turn, simulating the counterclockwise rotation of the Northern Hemisphere Earth. The air curves to the right and hits you in the face.
But don't cars turn much faster than the Earth turns?
Yeah, for sure, but, like, the Earth is really big, and wind is, like, relatively slow moving on that scale. So think of how far the air moves in, like, 6 hours.
A couple hundred miles.
Yeah, and in that time, the Earth has turned 90 degrees. The air is going sideways. If it started out going south, now it's going west. Coriolis totally dominates, flinging the air to the right.
But the air's really going straight, just like the ball in the merry-go-round.
Yeah, well, the high pressure is trying to push the air out and away from the center of the high-pressure system. Coriolis is always turning it back in towards the center. Coriolis and pressure are in balance. And the result is that wind circles clockwise around the high, parallel to the isobars.
Isobars? You mean those lines of equal pressure, like contour lines on a topo map?
Yeah, correct. Except that they're usually missing on those dumbed-down TV maps with little pictures of rain clouds and sunshine with smiley faces instead of real data.
Those would be great maps for radio.
Most visual aids are equally good for radio, Max. Gotta go. Bye.
All right, thank you for that, Chris Cross. It is Tuesday at 9:40 Pacific. This is time on Titillating Sports where we talk a little sailing. It's our SailSportTalk.com segment. And hosting this segment with me is always our friend Karen Lyle, who is also sheltering in place. Karen, how are you?
I'm doing great today, in a good mood.
Oh, that's a rare. Just kidding. Last week, Karen decided to interview me, and so we found out a lot of interesting things that I like to eat live mice, and I'm an ex-Navy SEAL. But today, Karen, you'd like me to ask you a few questions. And so I know that you said that you wanted to talk about stealth mode. Now, to me, stealth mode would be like something that our armed services have to evade radar. What do you mean when you say stealth mode?
Well, for the creative types who are creating patents and innovating designs and trying to get ahead of the competition, or, say, for example, for America's Cup teams who are trying to keep their boat designs in stealth, it means basically creating and working with your team and keeping everything a secret until you are ready to reveal yourself and say, hey, here's what I got.
And how does that affect you? Are you planning some scheme to release upon society?
Always. You know, well, I can't tell you right now because I'm in stealth mode. But, yes, I've actually been looking at and talking to other developers and planners and innovators about what things we can do to enhance fan experience in these days of COVID-19. And, I'm aware of other teams planning what they're planning and keeping it under wraps, but we know some things.
That's the thing I think is hard, too, when you talk about the fan aspect, because when America's Cup came to San Francisco, and they still have that beautiful pier not too far from our studios at Sports Byline, and I sort of figured that, you know, there was merchandise everywhere, there was promotion everywhere, every light pole and telephone pole had a banner on it, so I thought, well, I don't want to miss out when this thing's right across the street, literally. And so I went over and I could kind of see a little dinky boat going fast. And I was kind of thinking, this is it the kind of sport where you have to know what's happening? Kind of like, you know, if you go to a cricket match. Or is it more like soccer where, look, we all know what's happening. One guy is trying to get a ball on the other side. It's just, for me, it's hard to know who's winning. So what do we do to enhance that with the fan experience?
Well, I think if we were to look at SailGP, for example, SailGP used an app that was created for America's Cup when it was here that you hold in your hand in your device, whatever it might be, iPad or mobile device of any kind, and you can actually tap on the boats and see how fast they're going. There's like a grid on the water overlaid to the visual images that are being shown by helicopter, however they're putting the signal in from the cameras. And so live, you can be at the shore looking at the boats passing, but also have your app and multitask and go, oh, I want to see what the America's team is doing, or I want to see what the Stars and Stripes team or the American Magic team or whatever. And you can look at that and be able to see things. Now that's kind of, you know, adding technology. And I really think that that's going to be the theme that we're going to find in a lot of sports experiences going forward. It's already been heading that direction, but now we're really bumped into it. But, you know, in answer to your question about how do you as a non-sailor or non-racer be able to tell what's happening, it really depends upon the race. And so some races are really settling into a formula. Like, for example, with the CLGP race, they have, you know, patterned it after Formula One, and they have announcers and people who are explaining it, you know, step by step so that you know what's happening. But sailing is really very interesting because the wind changes, the current changes, the tide changes, sometimes right in the middle of the race. So, it does require a little bit of thinking, but statistics are really important because they can really make a difference in how the game comes out. You can predict based on statistics in a way you can't do with the ball sports.
Another neophyte question. I completely understand if you're going to be rowing crew that you go from a standstill, but when you're sailing and winds are whipping around, how do you properly all start at the same time, or is each one individually clocked? How do you do it?
Well, it really does depend upon the race because the rules are set up by the race, you know, the race committees. But basically, one thing that seems to be universally true is that the race begins before the start signal goes off. So usually there is a start line that gets laid out, and it's not actually laid out in the beginning. It gets laid out right before the race begins. And you'll see the boats in the time before. Sometimes they'll be going away from the line or come, and it looks like they're coming around. You're going, what are they doing? Well, they're usually positioning themselves to get in a good position, just kind of, you know, get a good trajectory, and also to sometimes block the wind of their competitor, because if their big sail is in front, you know, is on the upwind side, it's going to affect the boat that's on the leeward side, which is, you know, behind the wind. You know, if you're blocking the wind, that will take some of the wind out of, as the saying goes, the wind out of your competitor's sails. And so all this maneuvering is happening. So that, you know, 5 to 10 minutes before a race is really actually one of the more exciting times of the race. And a lot of times, broadcasters who will come in, CBS or whatever, will start when the race starts, and they missed, like, you know, the part that the sailors are all interested in, like, well, how did they get in place? Who's going to win? Because you can predict. you know, how well it's going to go by where they position themselves.
You know, it's funny, by the way, we're speaking with Karen Lyle, SalesportTalk.com, Rick Tittle with you. Fishermen a lot of times will look at yachts and say, you know, I can't believe you sail for pleasure because it can be rough out there. And for them, it's work. Do you sort of know where they're coming from when you think about the dangers and the work that comes into it? Or is that all kind of out the window and you sort of like feel at one with nature and all that?
Well, are you asking how I feel personally about it?
I'm talking to you, girl.
Okay. I think I'm always aware of the danger, and especially if I'm out on the ocean and there's, you know, I'm looking at my depth meter and it says 10,000 feet beneath me. You know, I'm just aware that I'm bobbing about on the surface and that there's a lot going on underneath that I don't know about that could affect me. And you have to kind of live with a little bit of that fear, and have it not overpower you. So there's kind of a limit that everybody has their personal limit. They're not going to go beyond a certain point. I'm not going to go out in the ocean beyond the Golden Gate if I see that the waves are at 15 feet in short intervals and that the winds are 35 knots and I'm in a small boat, because I'm just going to say, okay, I could die. You know, that would happen to, you know, it's possible, because it has happened to actually one of the clients of my piano finders business. He died at Pillar Point, you know, in 15-foot swells. In high winds, because he wanted to get his boat home, and it was really quite a sad thing, you know, because I knew his wife and children and him and so forth. So that's kind of always present with me, that's possible. And so I don't push myself to that limit. I usually try and stay safe as much as possible. But there's some amazing moments. Like, I was out on the bay last week and I saw three whales over by Alcatraz. And they were all spouting almost simultaneously, and it was thrilling. You could see it, like, you know, quite a ways away, because the water spouts were pretty big.
Well, it's a terrible story, the first part, and that's pretty cool about the whales. I remember reading a book where this guy was fighting. He was in a gale, and he was fighting these waves and he was solo, but that his boat would literally catch air for a second, slam back down, and then catch air and slam back down. And he said he fought that for 8 hours until he finally got underneath and he crawled into his hammock and he went to sleep. And I'm thinking, what what happens then? You just pulled all your sails down and then you just hope you don't capsize in a situation like that?
You mean he was single-handing? Is that the first part of the story?
He couldn't take it anymore. He did it for 8 hours, and he finally went underneath and went to sleep.
Well, you know, I can't say that I can speak from personal experience on this, because I don't single hand. I usually double hand. So I usually have another person with me, and usually somebody is more experienced than I on the boat. And but you can, if you're out in the ocean and you're in circumstances where you need, like, a storm or whatever, and you need to button up, you can go down below and close. You know, you want to make sure before you go out in the ocean for any extended time that your boat is waterproof, watertight, as much as possible. And you can basically close the hatch, put the hatch boards in, and some boats you can navigate from below. And there's also something called auto helm, which is a device, you know, it's where your navigation system is controlled by computer, and there's like a mechanical device that goes into the rudder that can basically steer the boat when you're not at the helm. So if it weren't for some form of auto helm, whether it's mechanical or electronic and mechanical, I don't think single handers would be able to do that. So,
gotcha.
Well, the resting part anyway.
Right. Last question for you. Tell us a little bit more about the Clipper Round the World race, where we're at with that, please.
Well, as you recall, they couldn't land in China because that was happening right at the time when COVID was breaking out. And so I think they went to the Philippines and left their 11 boats there. And then we talked, all the crew went to their various places. There were about 40 plus different countries they went to. And Sir Robin Knox, whom we talked to sometime last month, has been in Portsmouth, and he's been basically planning where the boats are going to go next, because basically that's part of, you just have to plan almost a year in advance, because there's a lot of logistics that have to be taken care of for something like the Clipper Around the World race, because people come to the shore, and you can imagine with the COVID-19 times that we're in, those cities, whoever is going to decide to sponsor and wherever the routes work out best for the currents, tides, and weather patterns, it's going to have to be something that the city is prepared to be able to handle whatever this new normal is that we're doing for when those boats come to shore, because usually there's a lot of people lined up, you know, just like America's Cup. People like to see the boats, especially if they've been following it and hearing about where they're at. They're really excited about that. So I think a lot of cities, you know, the harbor masters or whoever's administrators in charge of the ports are going to be working with, you know, all of the businesses and all of the yacht clubs and different locations on the shore, and just like everybody is doing right now, working with this city and the county and the state and the country to figure out what is our new norm. And it's going to be true for the water as much as it is for the land.
Go on the internet and check out sailsporttalk.com. And we've been speaking with the woman behind all of that, our friend Karen Lyle. Karen, thanks for your time as always, and we'll talk to you next week, kid.
Okay, we'll see you. I hope to see you and at least have an elbow bump, you know? You're taller than me, though.
Yeah, I'll make sure our elbows bump properly. Thanks, Karen.
Okay, bye-bye.
I won't hit you in the jaw. Don't worry about it. I'm Rick Tittle. We'll take a quick break, and we'll come on back on Sports Byline.